This podcast contains adult themes and language, and some of the things that we discuss may be disturbing to some listeners. In this podcast, we discuss sexual assault, torture, race, and murder. Listener discretion is advised.
Everybody, and welcome, boys and girls, to Fruit Loop Season 3, Episode 16. Thank you so, so much for listening. Fruit Loops is a podcast about true crimes committed by people of color and the victims that we don't hear or know much about. Now, contrary to popular belief, not all serial killers are straight, white, cisgender dudes. No! There are many well-documented cases of serial killers of color, and Fruit Loops is the podcast all about them. We will take deep dives into the fascinating lives and crimes of serial killers and true crimes committed by people of color and their victims that the media and entertainment commonly leave out because, well, the news is racist!
Allegedly.
And we are Wendy and Beth. She's Wendy, I'm Beth. Mm-hmm. We're not journalists, investigators, or psychologists. Just a couple of gals interested in true crime.
Yeah.
Also, the opinions expressed in this podcast are just that, our opinions. Please send any questions or comments to fruitloopspod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 602-935-6294, and we may feature it on a future episode. Also, our website is fruitloopspod.com, our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod, and our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And if you're not on Facebook, you can join the discussion on Twitter or Instagram by using the hashtag Fruit Loops Pod Discussion. All of the footnotes for each episode, which articles and other media we use to source this story, the music notes, all that stuff, can be found on our website.
That's right. And if you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash app, which you can download to your phone, or you can find online at Cash. If you are listening to this podcast, you already know how to find us. $ Fruit Loops Pod. Or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean Patron page. We also have some merch for sale. My mother still has not bought a mug, so I'm sure that she loves my brothers more than she loves me. On our website at fruitloopspod.com/merch. And if you can't help monetarily, problem, man. You can always give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and anywhere else you get your podcast from. And this is really, really important. This is what really helps the show. Be sure to share our show with your friends. All right.
Yeah.
So who are we talking about today, Beth?
Today, we're talking about Rhea and Sakina Ali Hammam, sisters who robbed and killed at least 17 women in early 20th century Egypt.
Oh, me. Oh, my. Well, before we dive into the story, Beth, how you doing?
I'm all right. My grandson was recently diagnosed with ADHD. My daughter was having a lot of problems with him because of his behavior. She works at a preschool with special needs kids, so she knows all the tips and tricks for dealing with behavioral issues. Mm-hmm. But he was still pretty challenging for her. Mm-hmm. And once he was diagnosed, I think it was a relief to her just to know what the problem mm-hmm. was. She suspected it because he's extremely impulsive and he has the energy of 10 kids. He's exhausting. he does not sit still ever. But having a doctor diagnose it rather than Dr. Mom diagnosing was really
helpful. Sure, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So they got him on a 504 plan at school and things are looking up.
That's
so
awesome. I think that's fantastic that he got a diagnosis. Me and your daughter are the same age and our kids are the same age.
Right.
And I have had the same struggles with my son. And it was just like the teachers would say, wait to get him tested. He doesn't need to be tested. And I was like, this kid, there's something going on with him. But
right.
If nobody is going to advocate for your kids, it has to be you.
Yeah. And the teachers, for whatever reason, the teachers won't.
They won't ever pinpoint it. Yeah. No. I know exactly. My son got kicked out of preschool because he was too impulsive.
Yeah.
And it was really, really frustrating. And we had him evaluated. And so I understand that struggle of I know that there's something going on here and I'm doing all this stuff to try to figure it out, but nobody is helping me. Like you guys are the experts. I'm just an expert on my kid, but you're an expert on child development. So help me.
Well, you would think so. But what my daughter has found is that they're not. they're not experts in these kind of problems.
So I'm just really, really grateful that your little grandson has got his diagnosis. Because now he has access.
They have to help.
They have to help. And he has access to a ton of resources for the rest of his academic career. And what I wanted to bring up was when I was in college, my best friend worked for on campus, we had a Center for Academic Resources. And they would hire other students to record themselves reading assigned books that were college material so that kids with ADD or kids with dysgraphia or dyslexia could consume the material without having their disability be an impediment. They also had kids who would sit with they would hire other college students to sit next to them in their classes to take notes for them. Nice handwritten notes. So this is a godsend, if you ask me, because again, he's going to be able to take advantage of these opportunities to get extra help throughout the rest of his academic career. And again, shout out to your daughter for just advocating the shit out of for her son. So that's awesome.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. So now we are going to get into our mailbag. And wait a minute.
Hello, angels.
Diddly doggone minute. We've got listener letters. Okay,
right
so what do you have, Beth?
We got a review from PhillyAday77 via Apple Podcasts, and they said, this podcast has it all. True crime, history, nuanced exploration of race, facts and statistics, context for the crimes, as much attention to the victims as possible, lesser known stories, just the right amount of profanity and laughter, and of course, hip hop air horns. Wendy and Beth put a ton of work into this weekly podcast and it shows. Definitely give this a listen. So thank you.
Thank you. Hip Hop
Air Horns, Day 77. Yeah. Awesome. And then from Diva 787, she said, the true crime I had no idea I needed. Beyond fascinating, I am learning and laughing and completely caught up in these stories.
Hey.
We needed this. So entertaining, and the wit gives me life.
Hey,
that's
you
so
give
awesome.
Us life,
yes,
Diva
we do. Thank you.
So I got an email from Kariana Tatum. She says, hi, Wendy and Beth. I'm in my last year of Colorado State University. Shout out to all the college grads.
Yep.
Hey, and I don't know why you went to such a white institution. We'll talk about that later. And just started getting into true crime podcasts this past summer. I had listened to a few weekly when in my head it kept nagging at me that I couldn't find any podcast about victims or perps of color. I pretty much chalked it up to what Wendy says. The news is racist, allegedly. No, it is. I just have to say allegedly so we don't get sued. I always muttered the naive serial killing is a white dude thing. So I am grateful and humbled and properly checked by your absolutely hilarious and amazing podcast. That is so sweet. I am blackety black and a proud woman. Again, I don't know why you went to Colorado State. you need to tell us who is deeply enveloped in combating racism in all facets of life. Sidebar, my campus is dealing with a blackface incident. Oh boy, the blackface. Anyway, and the criminal justice systems need some work, honey. Oh, yes, they do. I am so happy your podcast exists. I try to get my friends to listen, even though they think I'm creepy for liking true crime. Fuck them. I'm good. That's what Michael Jordan said when they were like, Michael Jordan, don't you want to be a like leader and like help your community? He was like, fuck them kids. Anyway, thank you, ladies. Thank you, ladies, for being a vital part of exposing the injustices within the legal system and infiltrating yet another white, bright genre. P.S. Have you ever heard of Ed Buck? Oh, yeah, we talked about that. That white, very problematic man who's killing all the black dudes in his home. Two or possibly more black gay men have suffered fatal drug overdoses at his hands, and he's a white Democratic donor, and check it out. And yes, thank you, sis. We have shouted him out. Not in a good way on the podcast, but we have brought him up because, yeah, it is kind of trash what's going on over
there. Add him to our list of bonus episodes.
Oh, we should do a bonus episode on him. Yep, yes. Oh, my God. You know what, Beth? You're amazing. Good idea. So now we are going to dive into the story, but we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to hit it when we get back.
Hi, friends. I'm Alicia.
I'm Stacy.
We make Trashy Divorces.
It's a good podcast about bad relationships.
Every week, we take two different stories of trashy divorces throughout time.
The rich, the powerful, the famous behaving badly.
So, so badly. Tune in every Sunday to get your Trashy Divorces fix.
It's trash candy for your ears.
So now we're going to get into the subject. So who are we talking about again, Beth?
We're talking about Raya and Sakina Ali Hammam, who are Egypt's most infamous serial killers.
Mm.
They, their husbands, and two other men began killing women in the Laban neighborhood of Alexandria in the early days of the 20th century.
So early days of 20th century, we're talking about World War One time.
Yes, thereabouts.
Pre-internet. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to dive into the stats, which is Wendy's favorite aspect of true crime. So, where's my air horn? There you are. So, Raya and Sakina are two African sisters from Egypt. They killed and robbed at least 17 women in Egypt. Their spree began in November 1919 and ended a year later in 1920. The sisters, with the help of their husbands, ran a drug and prostitution ring, or I guess sex worker ring now that we're more woke, in the Laban district of Alexandria in Egypt.
All right.
And that's it. Their stats are
pretty small.
It's pretty small. Yeah. Now we're going to dive into the setting. Yes, where this all took place, because we believe context is very important when describing these serial killers. So here we go.
So the setting is Alexandria, Egypt, during what is called Egypt's colonial period, when the British occupied Egypt in the early 20th century. Alexandria is on the Mediterranean Sea. It's basically on the northeast tip of the continent of Africa. It was founded by Alexander the Great in 332 BCE. Mm. It's the same as BC, but it stands for before the Common Era, which I guess they're changing, describing the eras as BCE and then CE for Common Era.
Oh.
So taking the Christianity out of it, because BC means before Christ. And then AD stands for a Latin word meaning in the year of our Lord. So they changed it to take out the religious context. So
I think that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, Alexander the Great was the king of the ancient Greek kingdom of Macedon. Interesting factoid, he was tutored by Aristotle.
Wow, Aristotle was his tutor?
What? So, yes.
That's really, really interesting. That's a cool fact. Thanks, Beth. Alexander spent most of his ruling years basically empire building. He went on a military campaign throughout Asia and Northeast Africa. And by the age of 30, he had created one of the largest empires of the ancient world. But after he died, his empire fell apart. This resulted in the establishment of several states ruled by Alexander's surviving generals and heirs. Alexander's settlement of Greek colonists and the resulting spread of Greek culture in the East resulted in what is called the Hellenistic period. Oh, that's a new one for me.
Cleopatra was the last Egyptian ruler as the Queen of Egypt, centered in Alexandria. But she wasn't actually Egyptian. She was Macedonian, a descendant of Ptolemy, a Greek general and companion of Alexander the Great. Ptolemy took control of Egypt, and his descendants ruled Egypt during what is known as the Ptolemaic dynasty.
The Egyptians begrudgingly accepted the Ptolemites as the successors of the pharaohs of Egypt, and the Ptolemies took on the traditions of the Egyptian pharaohs. They had themselves portrayed on public monuments in Egyptian style and dress, and participated in Egyptian religious life. The Ptolemies were portrayed as gods, and temples to the Ptolemies were erected throughout the kingdom. But Cleopatra's suicide at Egypt's conquest by Rome marked the end of the Ptolemaic rule in Egypt.
The city developed into a major port and became an important stop on the trade routes between Europe and Asia. Under Roman control, Alexandria remained the capital of Egypt, but during the 4th century CE, Common Era, formerly referred to as AD, civil war, famine, and disease ravaged the city's populace. And in the 7th century, Muslim armies swept into Egypt and bypassed Alexandria in favor of Cairo, which became the new capital.
Napoleon invaded Egypt in 1798. He recognized Alexandria's strategic importance and initiated the revival. After Napoleon was defeated in 1815, Egypt fell back under the control of the Ottoman Empire, led by General Muhammad Ali Pasha. Under his control, a new town was built on top of the old one. Egypt flourished after the Suez Canal opened in 1869. Every time I look at these dates, I'm like, how far away is this from slavery? So
it's like pretty much
4 years.
Still,
yeah. And Alexandria became one of the Mediterranean's busiest ports, attracting a cosmopolitan mix of people.
In 1882, during a period of civil unrest, British forces invaded and then occupied Egypt. During this time, the number of foreigners in the country rose from 10,000 in the 1840s to around 90,000 in the 1880s and more than 1.5 million by the 1930s. Foreign nationals benefited from the British occupation, but the British did very little to improve the way of life for the Egyptian people.
They weren't brutal occupiers, but they failed miserably at making the conditions livable to the citizens of Egypt and were oblivious to the suffering of the Egyptians. So Alexandria was a cosmopolitan resort city, but with great economic and class disparity. Alexandria was a paradise to the foreigners and the Egyptian elites, but the common people were living in squalor. So now we are going to get into the killer's early life, at least what we know about it. Take it away, Beth.
Yeah, so this is another one of those old historical stories where accurate information is difficult to discern. So we did the best we could, but please forgive us if we get something wrong.
Yeah.
Anyway, Rhea and Sakina Ali Hammam were born to an indigent family in a remote village of Upper Egypt. Rhea was born around 1875 and Sakina was born about 10 years later.
Their father abandoned the family and nothing is known about him. The sisters grew up with their mother and older brother. The mother is said to have been an egocentric woman who was unable to bestow love on her children. And the brother was a wastrel. I don't know what that word means. Wastrel.
Somebody,
should we look it up?
No, it's somebody who basically a waste of space.
Oh, like a shit bag.
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
A wastrel.
That's how I remember it. I remember words like that, like wastrel, waste of space,
waste
of skin.
Okay. And he had a hard time finding a job.
Desperate to get by, their mother reportedly introduced them to the life of crime. The sisters did work off and on in cafes or selling roasted vegetables, but they probably also sometimes joined their mother in robberies. Sakina, the younger sister, occasionally sold her body for fruit and vegetables. The family moved around a lot before settling in the village of Al-Zayat in the Nile Delta.
After marriage and divorce, Sakina fled the village with a lover, in the city of Tanta, North Cairo. She left him, worked for a few months as a sex worker, then took off with a new lover, to Alexandria in 1913.
3 years later, after having been widowed, Rhea also went to Alexandria with her new husband, Hezbollah Said, her deceased husband's brother. It was apparently a common tradition in Egypt at the time for a widow to marry her dead husband's brother. Mm. And she brought her daughter, Bedea.
No offense. I love my brother-in-law very much. But if my husband dies, I am not
marrying him.
Interested. So some sources say that Hezbollah was a thief and hashish smuggler, and that Raya and Hezbollah were banished from Kharf al-Zayat for smuggling hashish. Sakina also had a new boyfriend or husband. I guess we don't know. He's referred to differently in different articles, so that's why we don't know. His name was Muhammad Abdel Al.
With the outbreak of World War I and the economic crisis that struck Egypt's cotton industry, in which the partners of Rhea and Sakina both worked, the two couples decided to establish secret public houses. These kinds of places were widespread in Egypt's big cities, where visitors drank liquor and smoked hashish. Some were also brothels. Apparently, sex work was legal under British rule.
Beth, I think you say brothel funny.
Brothel?
You say brothel. And it's brothel.
Brothel.
Yeah. Brothel. I just think you say it funny. It's come up in past episodes. I'm like, why did you say it like that? Anyway.
No, I don't know. I just do.
Brothel.
Brothel. Brothel. Brothel.
Okay.
I'll try harder.
You do you, girl. You do you. I lost my
you
spot.
Do you.
So I'm really just killing time. Okay. So here we go. So they opened at least five of these establishments. The two couples then joined forces with Orabi and Abdul Razik, a pair of local thugs, for protection. And by the way, welcome to Culture Corner. The term thug is kind of racist, and we shouldn't use it.
All right. So a pair of local what?
Criminals. Criminals.
Criminals. Okay. So go ahead and say it. Do you want to say it again?
Or
do you want to leave Culture Corner in there?
I want to leave it and we'll do a Culture Corner because we haven't done it like a thorough one in a while. So
why is thug considered racist?
Because some would say that it's synonymous with the N-word. And particularly when the Ferguson events happened after, I think, was it Michael Brown? There were so many police shootings. But on the news, all they kept describing these young black people who were angry, using the T word, was thug. And somebody went on the news and was so furious. He said, why don't you just call them N-words? Because that's exactly what you guys want to say, but you can't. And so thug is like a cover word for an N-word, a young brown or black kid or person who is doing things that the white establishment considers to be unruly. And so
I see
it's
well, I'm white, so not always aware of these things, of course.
Yeah.
When I think of thug, I think of like what comes to mind usually first thing is like a mafioso or something, you know?
Yeah, like the Goodfellas, the Goodfellas.
The guys in Goodfellas. They're not in the upper echelon. They're in the lower echelon, and they're there to protect the other guys to beat people up or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's what I always think of. So,
you know, well, I think, and this is another thing, Fruit Loops is a safe space where we get to talk about these things
and
work them out and not have any judgment. I think maybe in the past that was an accurate description. But I think that since the Black Lives Matter movement and more these crimes against, you know, these police shooting black people and then the Black Lives Matter movement protests, I think that it's fair that the definition has shifted because you can only say so much on cable TV news, right?
Yeah.
And they want to say one thing, but they can't. So if they could use the N word, they would. Yeah. So they say that the thug word. And so,
yeah, now that I'm thinking of it, I don't think I would ever describe a black man as a thug, because I think I knew deep down that that is racist or offensive, would be offensive. So I don't think I would ever say that.
Yeah. But they do on the news a lot because they can't say the other word. Right. And so this is a tangent, but it's an important one, because the context that we got the information for this story used that word. And
it was an old article. I think it was from a newspaper from some time ago. So,
yeah. And so a language has evolved. Like I think we know now that it's a word that you probably shouldn't use. And if somebody uses that word, you could have been a question their motives, because they are clearly not informed and not a good person.
Okay. So anyway, we won't use that word. All right. So these criminals.
Yes. They did all this stuff for protection, and they acted as bouncers for the establishments and made sure that all of the customers paid their bills.
There are differing accounts on whether or not their establishments were actually brothels. Is that right?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to call,
I'm gonna pay attention.
Like, I don't want you to be weird about it or anything.
Brothels. The sisters later strenuously denied that they allowed sex work in their establishments, but it was widely understood that they did. They were also known to be places where secret lovers could go for trysts.
Trysts. I love that word.
Yes.
But in any case, the group prospered during World War I, but afterwards, amid rising national agitation in Egypt, things began to spiral downward. There was a popular uprising in March of 1919, which called for independence and removal of the British. Yeah, get those colonizers out of here. As Egypt pushed for self-rule, the economy plummeted, and so did their businesses.
The couple's economic situation had deteriorated to the point where they started to steal food. Hezbollah was caught and imprisoned, and then his wife, Rhea, was also incarcerated for 6 months. The group had to scrounge for another source of revenue.
Things are getting hot.
Here we go.
So now we're in the timeline. Now we're diving in to the splish splash fuckery. Here we go.
By November of 1919, the British authorities were busy quelling public resentment at Britain's occupation of Egypt, and general law and order had declined. Rhea and Sakina took advantage of this situation, since in the midst of the chaos, nobody was really paying much attention to what these ladies were doing.
Being a lady has its advantages, because nobody cares what we say or do. People don't even hear me in meetings when I'm speaking directly at them. So anyway, at the time, Egyptian women did not deposit their money in banks, but instead they invested in gold jewelry, which they wore on their person. These were the women that the sisters preyed upon. The gang's first victim was Hanim, Raya's neighbor, who Raya knew had bought some new jewelry.
Maybe this was an impetuous act, because Sakina was not in on it. After murdering Hanim, Rhea went to fetch Sakina. When the two sisters arrived at Rhea's home, Sakina found her husband and brother-in-law, along with Abdul Razik and Orabi, digging a grave.
Whoa. What are you guys up to over there?
Yeah, what are you doing?
Oh, no big deal. Just digging a little hole.
Digging a grave.
No problem. Would you like a TV dinner? No big deal here. So Sakina then returned to see Hanin's body laying open-eyed beneath a bench and was about to scream when Raya threatened to do the same to her if she uttered a word. Sakina was handed a share, which amounted to 3 Egyptian pounds.
This crime was then repeated with other victims. The sisters would lure women to their homes and would get the victim drunk. One of the men would stuff a wet cloth in her mouth, and the other would suffocate her. The men then removed the jewelry from the corpse, and the sisters took it to a goldsmith who was in on it. The goldsmith would buy the jewelry, and the proceeds would be divided between them.
This is quite the scam.
Yeah.
I mean, so let's see. Between November 1919 to November 1920, the women were disappearing in Alexandria. The first missing person report that came to the police was filed by the mother of a 25-year-old, Nazla Abu Al-Lay, who was wearing gold wristlets, a silver anklet, and earrings, and 2 gold rings when she went missing.
After this, a man reported that his sister Zanuba had gone to the market, met Raya, and never returned. A young 15-year-old girl reported that her mother, a poultry woman, I don't know what a poultry woman is, somebody who sells chicken?
I think so.
Okay.
I don't know.
In any case, her mother had gone missing. This report was followed by that of a man whose 50-year-old wife called Fatma Abdurrabu had gone missing. She had 54 pounds on her, 18 gold wristlets, a couple of gold bracelets, and a pair of earrings.
I'm just like picturing this gold jewelry on these beautiful women's like brown skin and just like,
yeah.
My mouth is watering. Like, I just love the sight on jewelry on black and brown women. I just think it is so gorgeous.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Missing reports came in continuously, one after the other. The next victim was a kerosene seller who was living alone in Al-Laban. A Sudanese woman reported her daughter, Farduas, missing in mysterious circumstances. She was wearing jewelry worth 60 pounds. That's British money, so I don't know what that really means. A gold bracelet costing 35 pounds and earrings and a gold necklace.
Common details in the reports included that the missing persons were all females and that the missing women were known to be wearing gold jewelry. Another common detail was that many of the missing women were last seen with both or either one of the 2 sisters.
Uh-oh, we got you, bitches. In the case of the missing woman named Farduas, Sakina's name was mentioned as someone she had been seen with, and she was brought in for questioning. Sakina was actually questioned several times, but female perpetrated crime was something that was simply unheard of. And the fact that the sisters were seen with some of the victims was not sufficient for the police to consider them to be strong suspects. They had no evidence. So now we are going to dive into the investigation and the arrest. So hit it, Beth. Boom.
The police became inundated with complaints about missing persons. And then on December 11th, 1920, a police officer discovered human remains on the side of the road near one of the sisters' residences. The completely dismembered body was damaged beyond all recognition, except for its long braided black hair.
Oh my goodness. Around the same time, a landlord was fixing the water pipes in a home that Sakina had formerly rented. When he began digging, he was soon overwhelmed by a terrible stench, and when his shovel encountered something hard, he groped around in the earth and realized he was holding human bones. Spooky.
Yeah. Suspicions turned to Sakina, the previous tenant in that building. A short while later, a police officer noticed an exceptionally strong scent of incense coming out of Raya's house on a daily basis. When he asked her about it, she replied that she was simply trying to get rid of the smell of alcohol and smoke from inside her establishment. But the officer reported this to the authorities, who knew that Raya was Sakina's sister.
The police commissioner then ordered a search of Rhea's home. Police noticed that floor tiles in a certain part of the house were newer than others. The commissioner ordered that the tiles be removed, and a heavy stench rose from below. Police officers then arranged for the floor to be dug and discovered corpses of two women and remains of a third, which turned out to be Farduas.
Police then decided to search all of the houses that Rhea and Sakina had previously lived in. Within a week, police unearthed 15 female corpses and the remains of two other women in a number of buildings. Unfortunately, most of the women could not be identified.
That's too bad. The sisters and their partners were arrested, along with the goldsmith and a few other women who were suspected of involvement. The investigation lasted a few months, with the suspects each accusing the others of committing the crimes. Come on, when you get interrogated by the police, you are not supposed to snitch.
They snitched and pointed fingers.
Snitches get stitches, y'all. Come on.
One story says that Rhea's 9-year-old daughter, Badea, was a key witness in the investigations and confessed to seeing her family members suffocating women and burying them under the floor of their houses, where they would sit down, eat, and carry on with their lives as if nothing ever happened.
Oh, Lord have mercy. The investigators pieced together a picture of the way the murders were committed. The medical examiner testified that the women were killed by suffocation rather than strangulation because the larynxes of the victims were uninjured. Investigators surmised that this form of murder was most likely committed after having administered to the victim a dosage of drugs.
Allegedly, Sakina, the younger sister, held out the longest under interrogation and refused to admit anything. But Rhea eventually broke down and made a series of confessions. Eventually, Sakina said that Muhammad and Hezbollah would strangle the women and bury their bodies in the houses where they were eventually discovered.
In December of 1920, a rumor spread that Rhea and Sakina were on display in the zoo. What the fuck? People flocked to the zoo to see the two notorious sisters. The rumor was totally unfounded, and the newspaper Al Haram remarked that the rumor itself indicated that the Egyptian people not only wished to strip Rhea and Sakina of their qualities as women, but also as human beings. I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, that's pretty weird. Let's go see the murderers in the zoo.
Now we're going to get into the trial of these murderers. So hit it, Beth.
The trial of Rhea and Sakina lasted 3 days, from May 10th to the 12th, 1921. There were 10 defendants, three were women, and the court heard the testimony of 31 witnesses. Sakina was the more aggressive during questioning, standing up to interrupt testimony and arguing during the questioning of some witnesses.
9 witnesses had been brought in for the defense, 6 withdrew, and the remaining 3 didn't have much to offer to the defense. The 4 defense lawyers didn't have much to base their case on. Their strategy was to deny the charges against the particular client and then shift the blame to one or more of the other defendants. And that's a pretty common defense strategy. Yeah, it's let's get them all pointing the finger at each other and then
everybody else. Yeah,
hope for the best. Yeah.
The trial attracted a lot of attention, as the Egyptian justice system had never seen a case like this. In one Egyptian newspaper, Al Aram, it was written that the case of Rhea and Sakina was in a class of its own. Quote, their crime has exceeded all bounds of human nature and rational behavior to reach a level of barbarism and savagery of unbridled evil.
They really don't mince words. And I wonder if this has to do with the fact that these are women, are lady killers.
Yes, I'm pretty sure.
And the media is like, they're trash, they're garbage, they're evil, they're Satan, they're all devils.
If you look at the photos we were talking about earlier today, we found some photos of them that are untouched, and they look pretty normal, you know. And then there's other ones that are like all over the internet. The ones that they usually have in the articles, and they look, I don't know, that it looks like they
were very disheveled and old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't look normal. They look kind of weird.
Almost unhuman.
Yeah, because it looks like they doctored these photos.
Yeah. They really dehumanize women.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I do think they dehumanize them.
And that's not to say, I mean, we got some recent reviews and people are like, you guys are trash. But we do our best to give respect to the victims, and we are not in any way like discounting the fact that they killed innocent people. Right. But again, context is everything. And so I think all these things are important parts of the story, is talking about their upbringing and their demeanor and how their trial went and how they were treated while they went through the justice system. It's all relevant.
Yeah, it's all relevant and it's all information. It's interesting. So whatever.
Yeah. So, you can have all the bags of dicks if you're not into it. That's cool. So on May 16th, 1921, Raya and Sakina, their husbands, and Orabi and Abdul Razik, the two quote-unquote
criminals, thugs,
we're not going to use that word anymore because it's racist, who had taken part in the actual murders of the 17 women, were sentenced to death by hanging in tents. Wow. Three of the defendants were found innocent, while the goldsmith, Ali Muhammad Hassan, was sentenced to 5 years in prison for his part in the crimes.
The newspaper, Ali Ram, one of the reporters at the court, described the spectators' reaction at the end of the trial. Quote, pandemonium broke out in the place. After about a quarter of an hour, the commotion subsided and the people started to leave the courthouse. As for the condemned, they were taken off to prison, Ray and Sakina to the women's prison, and the rest to Al-Hadra prison.
Okay, so now we're going to get into where are they now? I'll tell you. On December 21st, 1921, Raya and Sakina were executed. They donned red execution garments, like scarlet letter style, which mm-hmm. were specially tailored for them, as they were the first females to be handed a death sentence in modern Egypt. The next day, their husbands were also executed.
During the trial, Raya's daughter, Badea, was placed in an orphanage, and 3 years later, she died in a fire that broke out there. Some believe that a relative of one of the victims set the orphanage on fire to avenge her mother's deeds, but
wow,
that's just a rumor. We don't know, but it's pretty sad.
It is. Oh, that poor girl. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So the case of Raya and Sakina is infamous in Egypt. It became a source of inspiration for books, plays, and films. Many Egyptian and Arab tourists continue to visit the Laban area to see Raya and Sakina's home and the neighboring old police station where the initial investigations took place.
For years, Raya and Sakina were perceived as betrayers of the bread and salt relations of friendship. In many cultures, eating bread and salt together, or basically eating together, is supposed to form a bond of trust. In Arab cultures, eating bread and salt with a friend is considered to create a moral obligation to each other. Arabs use phrases such as, there are bread and salt between us, and salt between them, as terms of alliance. And there's a scene in Game of Thrones where enemies eat bread and salt together as a symbol of truce, trust, and honor. It's supposed to mean that nobody there will be harmed. And in the story, to break this code is considered to be the worst kind of betrayal. And just go off on a tangent, George R.R. Martin took a lot of inspiration from actual history and customs.
Oh, that is fascinating.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
Yeah, for sure. For shizzle, so, my nizzle.
That was White Nerd Culture Corner.
Well, you know, I always talk about how It's funny to me how like white people don't like understand like black food or like black hair or black anything, but like as a black person in the United States, I have to know every
I have to understand
yeah. all the white stuff just to survive. So it's just really cool that like George R. R. Martin is like down. So and you too, hashtag be like Beth. So because Raya and Sakina broke the code, they were portrayed as evil, fearful of the hold the names of the two sisters still have in the popular imagination. Mothers in Egypt have all but stopped giving the names Raya and Sakina to their daughters. That's wild.
Yeah.
Those are pretty names.
Yeah, they are. And I thought it was interesting that this is such an infamous case, and yet I've never heard of it before we started looking into it.
Yeah. Oh, for yeah. sure. Yeah. No, yeah. I've. What? Ryan Sakina? Yeah. The Aliha mom sisters? Like, okay. What?
But it's infamous there. Yeah.
Yeah. Give me another episode about Ted Bundy. No, thanks.
What the world needs is one more episode about Ted Bundy.
Oh my fucking God. We're done with that guy. Is he dead yet?
Or is he still in jail? No, he's dead. He's been dead for a long time.
We don't need to talk about him anymore.
No. So these days, the sisters are more often perceived as also having been victims themselves, victims of a loveless childhood, exploitation by family members and the men in their lives, victims of poverty and the political and social situation during the British occupation.
Yeah, they weren't coming up in a great
good
time.
So,
yeah, I mean, context. Yep. So now we are going to get into what we believe made the killer snap, as well as our takeaways. So hit it, Beth.
So as Wendy always says, hurt people hurt people. And I do think that they were victims of poverty and a shitty childhood, possibly manipulation by other people. And I wonder how much influence their men had over them. I don't know. We didn't hear much about their involvement.
Yeah,
the stories were all about the sisters, and it could be that they were not the aggressors. They might have been, but historically, the men usually are. And it's no excuse for what they did. But I think in the face of poverty, people will do a lot that they don't think that they're capable of doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, poverty is really painful. And when you are in poverty, you will do whatever it takes to get out of that pain if you can. I also think that just in terms of serial killers who are females, there is always seems to be this sex work element to it. And I also think that that kind of glamorizes female serial killers. To a certain extent, like media wise, you know what I mean? Like the story is sexier if there is like sex involved.
Yeah, that's true. And I think some of the stories talked about Sakina a lot because she did sex work and, you know, they talked about how awful she was because of that or whatever, you know?
Yeah, but I just thought that was interesting, and I wonder if the story would be the same if you didn't have the element of sex work involved
in it. Yeah,
in it, like you could just take all the sex stuff out, and it would still be a story about two sisters who killed 17 or more people.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And then buried their bodies in their house.
And buried, yeah, exactly. I think it's
more interesting.
Yeah, no, but we've talked about this before. When the media reports on female serial killers, and as particularly female serial killers of color, there's always either a sex element or like a witchcraft element to
voodoo
it. You know what I mean?
Something.
Like, like all the black female serial killers are like voodoo practitioners.
Yeah.
And they're really not. It's just the media doesn't know how to report on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to bring that up. That's my takeaway.
And I think when there's poverty involved, you know, women will do whatever they have to do
Absolutely.
To get by. And so sex mm-hmm. work is something that they can fall back on. So mm-hmm. I think that's why a lot of these stories have sex work in them.
Yeah, you're probably right. You're probably right. I mean, I don't know if Paris Hilton would have to resort to sex work ever. she will be all right.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of us at the bottom of the barrel, like, sometimes we just have no choice.
Gotta do what you gotta do, man.
Gotta do what you gotta do.
That's what my daughter and I today, we were trying to think of all those kind of sayings, like, gotta do what you gotta do. It's the nature of the creature. It is what it is.
It is what it is. By the way, I have a friend who taught, she would do sex education classes for prisoners in Maricopa County prisons.
Oh, wow.
And she learned a ton of sexy tricks from these female sex workers. And one of them is called, welcome to Culture Corner. It's called cheeking. So it's when a sex worker has a condom in her cheek. And when she goes to a John to perform oral sex, he doesn't realize that she's putting a condom on, but it's a way for her to be safe.
Be safe.
And so he doesn't notice, and he gets his rocks off, and she gets her money. Yeah. And everybody is safe. Wow. So anyway,
that's a neat trick.
I thought so too. And she showed us how to do it at a party one time. Anyway, so now we're going to get into how not to get murdered. So if you love true crime and you don't want to die, here's a tip for you. So hit it, Beth.
This segment is not intended to be victim blaming. We thought of the segment because I read somewhere that a lot of people listen to true crime because they want to know what they can do to be safer. This is not meant to blame the victims. It's just learning from other people's mistakes. Sometimes we have no suggestions for a particular episode and we'll just offer up generic tips.
All right. So here we go. These are generic tips because I've never been to Egypt. Nor have I ever killed anybody. So these are just some generic tips.
Generic tips.
So always be alert and aware of the people around you. Head on a swivel, as we always say. Be aware of locations and situations which would make you appear vulnerable to crime, such as alleys and dark parking lots. Whenever possible, travel with a friend. Me and Beth were just at a podcast event. We were like trying to like coordinate like parking next to each other so we can get murdered.
Yeah, so we can walk back to our cars together. Yeah.
Yeah. And I said something so dark. I was like, what did I say? Oh, well, if somebody else kills me, then I don't have to do it myself. Anyway. So if you want to kill Wendy, my address is just kidding.
Eat a bag of dicks.
Eat a bag of dicks. Anyway, so stay in well-lighted areas as much as possible. Walk close to the curb. Avoid doorways, bushes, and alleys where someone could hide. Walk confidently at a space. Beth always says when she walks when she's by herself, she like in her head says, I'm going to fucking kill you. And that really works. That energy
it does,
really works.
Right?
Like if you just say it in your head, nah, nobody's going to mess with you.
Fucking kill you.
Make eye contact with people when walking. Do not respect or do not respond to conversation from strangers on the street. So do not respond to conversation from strangers on the street. Continue walking. If you carry a purse, carry it securely between your arm and your body. Although a purse snatcher's intent is to steal the purse, your personal safety may depend on not clinging to it. But
so you might have to let it go.
You might have to let it go, but I was going to say something dark about, I don't want to have to pay my student loans anymore, so you can take my student loans and my life.
It's all in my purse. Go ahead, take it.
Bye. Do not use or wear anything that will impede your vision or hearing, i.e. iPods or like, you know, just
headphones
keep one headphone out so you can kind of know what's going on.
Yeah.
So now we're going to get into some serial killer and true crime news. Extra, extra, read all about it, Beth. Ooh, this one looks juicy.
In Detroit, between February 2018 and June 2019, bodies have been found in abandoned buildings in Detroit. Social media rumors circulated that there was a serial killer in downtown Detroit, but the police department denied it, saying, "There is false information circulating, and this is not true." Well, guess what? It's probably true.
Yeah. I am not going to take the word of any police department ever. I am certain they are lying.
In June of this year, D'Angelo Martin, 34, was arrested in connection with a sexual assault of a 26-year-old woman. Police suspect he is connected to other attacks and has been charged in the stabbing and sexual assault of one woman in May and the kidnapping and assault of another woman in June. He has also been charged in connection with the deaths of Nancy Harrison, 52, Trevisine Ellis, 53, Tamara Jones, 55, and Annetta Nelson, 57. The remains of another woman found in an abandoned building has now been identified as Deborah Reynolds, 64, and it is believed that she is another victim of D'Angelo's, and she was last seen in his company. So
that's really sad.
Yeah. So future episode.
Yeah, no, and it's kind of interesting that a handful of them are over 45. They're all older.
The women who were killed, they were all older women. Yeah.
Mm, interesting. Oh, well, so yes. We'll
keep our eyes on that list. One.
Yes, yeah. We sure will. Thank you, Beth. So now we're going to get into the shout out portion of our show where we shout out any content by people of color or about people of color or any marginalized groups and also any true crime goodies.
So I wanted to shout out a group. This is something I've been wanting to shout out for a while. They were recommended to us by Marlene Miller, who's one of our...
Hey, Mean Green Marlene!
Yeah, she's one of our Fruit Loops pod squad. She turned on to these guys, and their name is the Snotty Nose Rez Kids. They're native hip hop. They're just really good. She posted a song / video in our group, and it's called Bougie Natives. Oh. I must have listened to that song like 10 times in a row. I love it, yeah, and I'm obsessed. And I also wanted to mention that Marlene Miller has done some of the music that we play in our podcast. Mm-hmm. And so you look in our footnotes, and you can see which songs she's contributed
to.
Yeah,
she's so fucking talented.
She
blows me away. And the fact that she's like, I mean, I can't wait to meet you, Mean Green Marlene Miller. Like, I cannot wait. Like, you are just so dope, and thank you so much for just like fucking with us and you know,
helping us out.
She really is like Fruit Loops Pod Squad, like
Queen Bee.
She's the queen bee of our pod squad. So thank you, Marlene. We love you so much.
And thank you for introducing us to the Snotty Nose Rez Kids. I love them.
Yes. Are they? I saw the post, but I haven't checked if they're on Spotify. I'm going to have to.
They are. I think they are.
To them. Okay.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure because I have it somewhere and I think it's Spotify.
Okay. Cool.
Subscribe to them somewhere.
Hey, speaking of Spotify, Fruit Loops is on Spotify. So
yes.
Like and subscribe.
Like and subscribe.
So, speaking of, where where can the people find us, Ben?
Our website is fruitloopspod.com. Our Facebook page is Fruit Loops Pod. And our discussion group is Fruit Loops Pod Discussion on Facebook. We are also on Twitter and Instagram at Fruit Loops Pod. And links to our sources will be in our footnotes. If you want to support the show, you can send us a donation on the Cash App, which you can download to your phone. Or you can find online at cash.me/$FruitloopsPod. Or you can become a monthly patron through our Podbean patron page. This will help us pay for things like our website and pod hosting. There's no minimum and no commitment. Even a dollar would help. We also have merch on our website now at fruitloopspod.com/merch.
All the things Beth said are 100% true. This is a weekly podcast and new episodes drop every Thursday. So until next time, look alive, guys. It's crazy out there.